Hi, my name is Bob.
I received a lot of gifts from this program, and one of the gifts I received is a stepmother. And as you know, many of you know, my father just recently got married about a year ago, and my father asked me to be the best man. And we invited some Al-Anon people as well as people that they worked with. And the big moment was here. Bob was going to give the toast. I was nervous as heck. Asked God for some help. And the first five words out of my mouth was, "Hi, my name is Bob." And the Al-Anons, as they usually do, sat in the corner and said, "Hi, Bob." And some of you were there. Love and acceptance is what I got from this program. You guys told me I was okay, but I didn't think I was okay. I want to tell you a little bit about the first meeting that I went to. I was 18 years old. My father took me to a meeting. I must have been outweighed in age by at least 20 or 30 years. How can I possibly understand? How can you understand my problems? I was talking about girlfriend in school. You guys were talking about wives and jobs. And I already knew about Al-Anon. My father threw a One Day at a Time book on my desk maybe 3 or 4 years ago before I came to the program. I read a lot of things, and it said serenity, serenity, serenity. So what did I do? I go into the meeting, and I put my serenity face on. You guys don't know that I'm hurting so bad, and I was. And so when I get there, what did you guys do? The ladies come up after the meeting and say, "Bob, you're a good-looking guy. Bob, keep coming back." And that was really helpful for me because I really couldn't, you know, I was really hurting inside. Of course, at 18, I was too cool to go back. And so I came back when I was about 20 years old, and I've been out here ever since. And I want to talk a little bit about the 12 steps. I remember about 18 or 8 months into the program, it was suggested that I get a sponsor. Matter of fact, every meeting I go to, it seemed like 10,000 people were saying, "Get a sponsor, get a sponsor." And for people that don't know what a sponsor is, it's someone that will help you work the steps of the program. Someone will be there to support you. I have my sponsor come up to me and say, "Bob, I love you." And I can say, "I love you too." And I'm just beginning to understand what the word love means. And so I got my sponsor in an unusual way. I lied. I did. It was the first time at the Sunday night meeting, SOS meeting, real close here. And he came up to me. I was wearing my Bermuda shorts, my T-shirt, my sandals. It was just a lie. It was hot. And I looked pretty young, and he wanted someone to do an Al-Ateen sponsorship. And I looked like maybe I could communicate with the kids. And so he asked me, how many years was I in the program? Well, I've been in the program for 8 months. And I go, 2 years. You see, I needed to do that, and I'll tell you the reason why, and this will tell you exactly how I grew up. I needed to be better than you to feel equal to you. I had to be faster, stronger, smarter, just to feel like part of the bunch. And so I did this, and during the meeting, I got that overwhelming sense of guilt and remorse, and what happened was I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't want to wear the mask anymore. It was too much. Too much dishonesty, too much despair. So that was a big week for me, by the way, and I'll get to that later. But so I raised my hand in the meeting, and I say, "Hi, my name's Bob." "Hi, Bob." And I said, you know, I told him a little story, what happened to me the weekend before, which was very special in my life. But I had no intention of telling this person that I lied to him. No intention whatsoever. Because that's like your pants down, you know, help. But I did. And I said, you know, I said this. And after the meeting, the guy I never met before came up and gave me a hug, didn't say what his name was. And that's the love and acceptance I feel in this program. He just gave me a hug. And like I said, I've been asking God for a sponsor before this, but I was never willing to go up to someone and say, "Can you be my sponsor?" I didn't like the rejection. So what happened was he asked me, "Would you like to be a sponsor?" And that's just one experience of many that I've learned in this program, that miracles are possible without my consent. And I heard that someone say that, and it's so true. Miracles are possible without my consent. And I may not be able to accept this miracle, I can or not, but it's without my consent, and it happens. And that's my higher power working in my life. So I met this person, and he said, "Come over to my house." Uh-oh. "We're going to work the steps." And I went over to his house, and I met his lovely wife, Sharon, and his name was Art. And his wife was in the program, and his daughter was in the Alateen program, and they were very functional, and they're working the program. So this is a good place to be. And Art sat me down and said, do you understand the first step? Do you understand the word powerlessness? Do you understand the word unmanageable? And an experience a week previous to that gave me the answer of yes. And I said, well, I kind of understand, but I kind of don't. And he says, well, think of something that makes you identify with the word unmanageable. And a week before, this is my horse story. It was a horse that showed me what powerlessness was. And what it was we had this big trip to Half Moon Bay, 4th of July weekend. Me and a bunch of friends would go and rent these horses. We'd go out on the beach. And I brought this girl that I wanted to impress. Uh-oh. Expectations galore. We were going to go on the beach and our horses would ride side by side. You know, wind throwing through our hair. It was like Gone with the Wind and Young and the Restless, all rolled up into one, and we would hold hands. I don't know, I remember horses being pretty big, and how can we hold hands? But this was my expectations. And she would smile at me and say, gosh, Bob, I love you. This is so special. And when my horse hit the beach, it took off and left her behind about a half mile, a quarter mile back. And I'm galloping along, oh, this is great, this is great. We're running on a beach, oh no, oh no. So I'm holding on to the horse going, stop, please stop. And this will tell you a little bit about what I am like, or how I feel, is this horse would not stop. It would not turn around. It would not turn around for the friend behind me. So what I would do was I was going to pull on the reins until it would stop, and it didn't stop. And I cursed and swore and said, you darn horse, get me, turn me around. And this wasn't a 12-step horse. It was fighting back. It was pissed off. And I said to the horse out loud, you're not doing what I want, so I'm going to pull and pull and pull until you do what I want. And that's exactly what I did with the alcoholic. That's exactly what I did with my family and the people that I love. You didn't do what I want, so I'm going to pull on the reins until you do what I want. And this is the way I lived my life for a lot of years. And I had to come to the program to see this is not the way I want to live my life anymore. So he said, okay, now we're done with the first and second step. You come to believe, I've been convinced that of the first two steps, now you're ready for step three. Uh-oh. I have to turn myself. I think as Al-Anons, we're guaranteed one thing. No matter how big or small the problem is, self-will and blame get us deeper into the problem. And I really believe that. And he said, well, also I'd like to say that my sponsor said, he would give me the big book and he said, read this. They'll tell you about the steps. And it's good that he did that because it's into action, how it works. And I had to really learn how this system worked. And it's a system for living. And so what I did was I read the big book, and I had no idea that Bill W., the co-author, the author of the 12 steps, suggested that we take the third step with someone. And he also suggested that we have a third step prayer, and that when you take the third step, you say this prayer. And Art made me do this. He made me sit down and say, you know, we'd sit on his couch, and he'd say, you know, say this. Even though I wasn't maybe not ready, and I think I was. I think God just set up just the way it was. And so I would take the third step. And he says, we're all right now. We're on to the fourth step. And we said, he explained a little bit about what the fourth step was. But he said, we did okay today. Go home and write a list of the fourth step. So I went home and I wrote it. And I did exactly what the fourth step said to do. And that's to list my faults. And he had me list them in different areas. The first area being resentment. The second being fear, and the last one being sex. Uh-oh, the sex. Boy, that word just scared the stew out of me. Sex. And oh, wow, we have to reveal what that is. And, you know, I realize now that from reading the big book is that sex is a God-given instinct. But where we get into problems is when we use or abuse that God-given instinct. And what is it? Just satisfying a human ego. So I have to work the fourth step to deflate my ego. And I'll tell you, anybody that knows me knows I have a big ego. So I wrote down my resentments and fears and the things with the sex and took it back to Art. And what he did, what I think is real special, was he shared that part of the list, his list, that corresponded with mine, showing me that I wasn't the only Joe, the only Bob, or whatever, that suffered from that same thing. What it told me was he understood. He understood. And that's what I needed. So after I list my faults, we get into the fifth step. And this is where it really gets sticky. Because this is where we have to look at every twist and character defect we have. And really, it's really simple with the fifth step. It's simply saying that, did we unturn every stone? Did we look at every twist of character? Did we do and say it all? And you see, for me, that's hard. For me, I always kept a secret. For me, it wasn't any of your business. And for me to do it, I mean, I remember leaving his house and saying, gosh darn it, I wasn't going to tell you any of this. I was going to take it to my grave. And that's really how I felt. But in the fifth step, you guys showed me that I can open up. I can let it go. And that was good for me. Now we get into the sixth step, and we have what we call the replacement step, is where we let go of the bad character defects, and we have a void. Hey, I think God helps us fill that void. And the way I think He does it is He replaces gratitude with self-pity with gratitude, intolerance with tolerance, and a wide variety of things like self-hate with self-acceptance. And those are the things I learned here. I had to learn from you guys exactly what was normal. Like I mentioned before, I thought normal was kicking in doors, punching walls, and stuff like that. And you guys showed me that when you hit the wall wins, not your fist. So after I did the sixth step, or had me say the seventh step prayer. So there's more praying there. We have the third step prayer. We have the seventh step prayer. Obviously, there's a lot of praying in this program, a lot of contact with our program. You see, I really never knew how to pray. My prayer was, if you did this, I would do this. If you get my mother fixed, if you get her this, I would go to religious instruction 2 times a week instead of once. That's the way I did it. Now I can come up here and say, God loves me just the way I am. And that's so special to me. And it's really special. And so after the seventh step, he said, we're okay right now. And I'll tell you, my friend Henry's not here, but I felt like, he always says, I was on cloud nine, man. I was on cloud nine. And that's the way I was. I was on cloud nine. The promises of the steps were coming true to me. And that just, it felt like a total weight was lifted off me. Well, I haven't seen Art for a little while now because of some financial reasons he had to move away. And that's unfortunate. But we still keep in contact. From there, I kind of learned the eighth and ninth step, the amends step, from my father. As a matter of fact, I learned a lot from my father. He's been in the program many, many years. And through his example, I've learned a lot. On occasion, we'd go biking around Stanford, and we'd talk about the seventh step. And I mean, there's just a new level of communication that was never there before we came to the program. So how did I learn the eighth step from my father? Well, you see, he has his mother that he calls, and she's in a rescue home right now. She's doing pretty well, but now she's kind of old. And on every week, give him a call. And for a long time, I would not call my mother. Matter of fact, I'd only stop by maybe on Christmas or Mother's Day just for charity, just because I thought it was my duty that I'd be there. I mean, I'm very unfortunate, but that's the way I felt. And I had to come here to realize that I have to love her just the way she is. And I do today. And the way I practice my eighth step is the same way I think my father does his, by calling his mother, and telling her that he loves her. And you see, he would talk to my grandmother, and she's kind of not all there anymore. And she talked for a little while, and then he would hand us the phone, and we'd have to talk to her. And then I go, Kim, here, you talk to her. It was kind of like a phone tag. But you see, this is how we learn how to communicate with other people. And so now, on a daily basis, the way I work my eighth step, one of the ways I work my eighth step, is by calling my mother and telling her I love her. And that's really special. I would have missed this if I didn't come here. I would have missed this. Right now, you know, I could take her out to lunch and we could talk about the good times. And sometimes I forget that there was good times. And she reminds me there was good times. And, you know, with the trips we went on, the huckleberries we picked, all those good things that I may have forgot in my own illness. Also, another way I work my eighth step and ninth step is be a better Bob. Forever was I trying to show people my pain in my family by either taking stuff or what have you. And by being a better Bob, I work these steps to the best of my ability and talk to God on a daily basis. And I believe that makes me a better Bob. I come to meetings and read daily. And now we'll see the tenth step, spiritual maintenance. I always need to maintain my spiritual self. And I say that because I always was the guy that made absolutes on New Year's Eve. I will never do this again. And I would have this list, a list of goals. And unfortunately, those goals would die out about 6 days later, and they'd be forgotten. And this program is of rigorous honesty and also a lot of getting in there and doing some action. Rigorous action. Proper action, I like to call it. Doing proper action is doing the steps and talking fire on our power every day. And by doing so, I can feel love. I can reach a better understanding of what my higher power's will is for me. You know, some people say that I don't know what my will from God's will. Well, if you develop the personal honesty, I don't think there's any difference. And that's what I'm trying to do every single day. 11th step. I always hated 11th step because when they pass around the thing, that was the longest step. And you have to read it. Saw through prayer and meditation. And I would hate it, so I'd memorize it. Just so when it came to me, I'd know how to say it. Saw through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. It doesn't have to be perfect. I just have to improve it. And that's the good news. Always wanted to be perfect, and just can't do it. So improve my conscious contact. And I do this by practicing the 11th step. I think the 11th step, the gift of prayer, is one of the best gifts I ever got in this program. It's just a conscious contact with the God of all power, all love. Now we're on to the 12th step. And it says, practice his principles in all our affairs. I go to school, and on my notes, I put GWNM, God's will, not mine, on every note I take in school. Because when the professor does something wrong on the board, and Bob knows it's wrong, I try to maintain myself. Or if Bob gets a bad grade and wants to try to compare with the other guys how they did, God's will, not mine. And I've learned that it's God's will, not mine. And carry this message to others. I try to carry it to my family. I'm just trying to be the best Bob I can. I have a new relationship with my sister. It's not like we broke off or anything. But the relationships we had before was we'd be at each other's throats all the time. And that's not good. And the new relationship is that we can talk on a one-to-one basis. And sometimes when she would have a little problem, she would come and talk to me. And she says, stop sounding like Dad. You sound too much like Dad. I told her if she didn't come tonight, I would talk about her. She didn't come, so I would talk about her. I've received a lot of gifts in this program. I'm extremely grateful. The meeting and the acceptance and the love that I shared. The power of the love. I never understood the word love. I always thought it was I do for you, you do for me, and we love each other. And I'm learning that's a lot different now. And as what you guys are teaching me, I would never hug a man. I would not. And when my sponsor says, he loves me, I can say, I love you. And I'm just beginning to understand what that means. And I'm learning a greater understanding of the power of the higher power. And the power is when we stand together and we say, our Father. Now I'm a participant of this thing called life. I'm a participant, not a spectator. I always thought that you guys were out to get me. I always thought I had to be better. And I'm learning that's just not true. All those unfounded fears, all that stuff that I thought you guys were going to do to me, just was not true. I'm learning that that this program does give miracles. I remember, always being emotionally uptight, and I'd come home on a Friday night and my father would be eating his life cereal, maybe reading his Al-Anon books, and I'd come in, it'd be late at night, and I'd be upset, and he would talk about the program, and the glimmer in his eyes and how he talked about the program just got me so attracted to this program. And like the 11th tradition says, this is a program of attraction, not promotion. And you know, I would never get kicked out of the house if I didn't come here. I was attracted to you. I was wondering where he came up with all these things, and now I know where he came from. He got it here. And the program has really helped bring our family together. And forever I'll be grateful. And I know exactly where I got it. It was from here. I'd like to say that today that my life is better than it's ever been. I'm living in the spirit of a God of my understanding. My home and my job, my friends and family, and everything and a wide variety of things fill my life. And I practice the 12 steps daily. I read daily. And in all my affairs. And the spiritual illness, the fear, the guilt, the shame, the self-pity, they no longer control or dominate my life anymore. And I'd like to say that the trust and the confidence in God's care is the antidote to fear. And the shame and the guilt has been resolved as a result of the steps. And a variety of other things that have been resolved. And I like to say that, I hang around now with people that are filled with life and filled with joy. And that's exactly where I need to be right now. So I'd like to thank you for having me up here. So thank you very much.
Time, I'd like to turn the meeting over to our second speaker this evening, Peggy C.
Hi, everybody. My name is Peggy. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Are there any other members of Al-Anon in the room tonight? Are there any members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the room tonight who would care to raise their hand? I'll try to keep it clean for you guys. I don't know about you, but before I got to the program of Al-Anon, I was perfect. Bob was talking about trying to be perfect. And I wouldn't want to ruin anybody's image if you have already convinced your spouse, and they happen to be here, that you are perfect. So I really will try to keep it clean. I got to this program 16 years ago. And when I got here, I experienced a moment of humility. And what led up to this point of humility was my husband's sobriety. I had been married to this man for 15 years, 15 and a half years of his drinking. And for 15 and a half years, I had been raising 8 children. And hoping, wishing, praying that this man I was married to would stop drinking so that I would be okay. I wished, I hoped, I prayed that he would change so that I would be different. And you know what that son of a gun did? He found Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety, and I didn't have anything to do with it. And you know what happened after he found Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety? He stopped drinking, and I was not okay. He started changing. And I was not the least bit different. And I was pissed. I'm sorry, I was going to keep it clean. It took me 5 months to recognize that what I had hoped for, what made such perfect sense to me, was not going to happen. And you know, when you're living with active alcoholism, it makes such sense that if he would stop drinking, I would be okay. Because he's my only problem. He is the reason I feel the way I do. He's the reason I act the way I do. He's the reason our kids are leaving home. He's the reason our kids are drinking and drugging and running away from home and shoplifting and ditching school all at the same time. During the late 60s, 4 of our kids were teenagers all at the same time. My husband often says that I was a born Al-Anon waiting for an alcoholic to happen. I was raised in a non-drinking home. I never saw my parents drink. There was never alcohol used or abused in my home. So when I got out into the world at about age 17, everybody in the world drank more than I was used to seeing. So drinking didn't mean anything to me. At 17, I married my first husband, who just happened to be a physically abusive psychotic with sociopathic tendencies. Now, I need to tell you that at the age of 5, my higher power introduced himself to me. He came into my life and he let me know he was there. And so from the age of 5 to 17, I had developed a wonderful relationship with a very loving, personal God. But what I did with this relationship was run to the top of the mountain with it. I was God's right-hand man, and I was going to save the world one person at a time. Now, obviously, the first person I chose was this young man who was later diagnosed as psychotic with sociopathic tendencies. During that 5.5-year marriage, we had 2 children, one of whom died. And that was one of the most beautiful spiritual experiences I have ever been through. Now, that may sound very strange. I was 21 years old when this child was born and died. He had a heart condition, and he died when he was 5 weeks old. And I can remember talking on the telephone to the nurse at the hospital. It was actually a nurse's aide. And she called me up to tell me that the baby didn't make it. And he was supposed to have had 30 more days or something like that. And I said to this young lady, I said, "What happened?" And she said, "Well, I guess I kept him out of the incubator too long. I was feeding him and I kept him out too long and he didn't make it." And out of my mouth at 21 years of age came, "Honey," here I am 21 saying, "Honey, I hope you won't let this experience interfere with your ambition to be a nurse. I hope you will take this experience and learn from it. I think you'll make a really good nurse." And I look back on that and the following days. During the funeral, I have a sister who's 3 years older than I. And all my sister could do during this funeral was cry and say, why, which is a natural human response to the death of a child. Why? And I can remember going up to my sister and trying to answer her question of why. And what I said to her was, "I don't know why. But what I do know is that God is in charge of life and God is in charge of death. And whatever God is in charge of is good. I don't understand it any more than you do, but I trust who is in charge." Now, here I was 21, and I had all this wisdom, and I put it into practice. But I finally, through a series of a broken nose, fingerprints around my neck, took my 2.5-year-old son, put him in a wagon, grabbed my purse, and walked. Walked away from that marriage and never really looked back until I got into Al-Anon. I walked away and I started a new life. And in that new life, I did a lot of talking to God. And most of what I said was, "I know you don't want me to do this, but I want to do it anyway." I began about 3.5 years of some real rebellion. Now, I did horrible things like I cut my hair because my first husband had not allowed me to do that. I started smoking. Today, I'm sorry about that. But I started smoking because my first husband would not allow me to do that, even though I didn't even want to. I went to work. My first husband would not allow me to go to work. And, of course, I needed to now. I had a son to support. And I also went out and decided to have an affair with a married man. I'd never done any of these things before, you see. I married at 17, divorced at, 21, 22. And, of course, as a result of that affair with a married man, I got pregnant and had to leave Southern California because that's what you do. Almost, 37, 38 years ago, when you got pregnant, you left. And so I moved to Northern California. And for 3.5 years, I dated, I raised my 2 children, and I got to a point in my life where I didn't like what I was doing because I didn't like me, and I made some drastic changes in my life. I became a better person, And I also reached a point in my life where I really thought that I was the best mother and father that my kids could have. I didn't need a man in my life. I didn't want a man in my life. I liked dating. I liked working. I liked my life the way it was, and I liked me in it. And there I was, not wanting to get married, not even wanting a man in my life, when a series of phone calls, business phone calls, I met this beautiful man and fell in love immediately. As a matter of fact, we got married 5 weeks after we met. Now, this man was a widower with 5 little girls. And I had 2 children, a boy and a girl. I can remember calling up my mother and saying, "Mother, am I crazy?" And she said, "Peggy, if there's anyone in this world that can handle it, it's you." And I believed her. And so I married this widower with 5 little girls, and at the age of 26, overnight, I had 7 children, ages 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, and 11. Hey, if you're an Al-Anon looking to hang on the cross, your hand is permanently stuck to your forehead. Can you think of a better scenario? And of course, this man, this beautiful man that I married, just happened to be an alcoholic. Now, we didn't know that. As a matter of fact, the first year that John and I were married, I saw him drink and get drunk probably twice the first year. Maybe 3 times the second year. Maybe 4 times the third year. The progression of his disease. Until the last 6 months or so of his drinking, he was drinking and getting drunk maybe 4 times a week. 4 times a week, the progression of my disease. You see, if he had been drinking and getting drunk 4 times a week when I met him, I might have, I don't know, but I might have recognized there just might be a problem. But as his disease progressed, my disease of the acceptance of his disease progressed right along with him. And you know, I had some painful times, some miserable times during those drinking years, but neither one of us knew that drinking was the problem. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. My husband didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know he was one. He didn't know he was one. I believed all of the reasons he gave me for his drinking. He was tired. He needed to relax. His boss was the son of a bitch. He got a raise. He got fired. It was too hot. It was too cold. He needed a pick-me-up, a let-me-down. His back hurt. He believed them. And so did I. I had no idea that I was living with an alcoholic. What I did know was that I hated this man when he was drinking. And I loved him when he was not drinking. When he was drinking, he was someone I didn't know and someone I didn't want to know. And when he was sober, he was this caring, loving, gentle, attentive person. I knew, without a shadow of a doubt, to the bottom of my toes, that this man loved me and our 7 children more than he loved anything in the entire world. And equally as strong, I knew that if he really loved us, he wouldn't do the things he did. Now, here I am living with this dichotomy of beliefs. It's no wonder I was confused. It was no wonder that today I believe my behavior, my reactions, and my actions were much more damaging to our children than my husband's drinking ever was. When John got sober, one of our daughters was 18 at the time, and she was still living at home. And she came to me, and she said, "Mom, I always knew what Dad's problem was. He drank too much. but I could never figure out what was wrong with you. Now, fortunately, I had enough program to understand what it was she was saying. And as I look back on those years, I recognize that trying to see our home life through the eyes of our children, which I never, ever could do until I had heard people like Bob, like my own children share, Alla Teens share, I am now able to kind of see our home through their eyes. And what they got to see was they come home from school and here's this loving, caring, warm, their mother. And pretty soon, mother would turn into this ice cube. She was unfeeling, uncaring, absolutely not there. And they never knew when that was going to happen. They did not hook up my behavior to my husband's drinking. And yet, as we all look back, I know that when John came home from work, if he was already drunk, immediately the walls went up. I wasn't there, cold, unfeeling, uncaring. Or if he hadn't started drinking yet, he would walk to the refrigerator, and on the top of the refrigerator was his Jack Daniels, and he would get out some ice cubes. And as soon as those ice cubes went into the glass, click, Mom would turn off all emotions. What I recognized after I got into this program is that a lot of us learn how to turn our emotions off. What I didn't understand when I was turning off those emotions, because I didn't want to hurt anymore. So I didn't want to feel. And I thought I could just turn off the negative emotions. And what I didn't know is when you turn off your emotions, you turn off your emotions. And you don't get to feel the good stuff either. Another thing I didn't recognize is that once I learned how so well to turn off those emotions, it was very difficult to learn to turn them back on again. And so I have learned to do that in Al-Anon. Bob was talking about the steps, and when he was talking about them, I was thinking my first experience with the steps was with John's sobriety. And for 5 months of his brand new sobriety, I used to go to AA meetings with him, like the rest of us, to make sure he heard what everybody said, and we could talk about it when we got home. And I remember the first night he came home from his AA meeting and he told me he was an alcoholic. And I thought, hallelujah, our troubles are over. And I was excited because I realized here's the problem. Now, obviously, if drinking is the problem, then the solution is not to drink. I mean, that makes sense to me. So he was never going to drink again. Of course, he hadn't made that decision yet. But I had, and I just lived my life as if he was never going to drink again, and I was going to be fine. And he brought the big book home, and I read it. He read it first, but I read it too. And I read those steps. And I worked through all 12 steps the very first night. It was easy. I knew that he was powerless over alcohol. And that I could not manage his life. I knew there was a power greater than he was that could restore him to sanity. And so I turned his will and his life over to the care of God as I understood God. And probably like you, I had been taking his inventory for years. I had that one down pat. And I had even shared it with a few understanding friends who would not think less of me if they knew about him. Anybody relate to that? And step six, I was entirely ready to have God remove his defects of character, and I had humbly asked God to remove his shortcomings. And I had a list of all the people he had harmed. And see if this one fits. Step nine. For years, I had been apologizing for his behavior, rationalizing his behavior, justifying his behavior. I had been making amends for his behavior for years. When I got into Al-Anon, and it was because, through a series of circumstances, I was driving home from a bowling tournament. This is what happened. And I was on the freeway. John had been sober for 5 months. And I got this overwhelming desire to feel sorry for me. And I looked around at what was going on in my life. My husband was not drinking. He was in AA. He was growing. He was changing. He was becoming the person I always knew that he could be. I looked around, and by now we have 8 children. My husband was a periodic, in case you wonder why we have 8 children. He was a periodic alcoholic. I was driving home from this bowling tournament, and I had this overwhelming desire to feel sorry for Peggy. My husband was sober, and all of our 8 kids, to my knowledge, were behaving themselves on that day. Now, that in itself is a miracle. But my scapegoats, the ones I always looked to when I had that desire to feel sorry for me, I couldn't find a reason. And it struck me so funny, because I had been to enough AA meetings with John to know that I didn't have to feel sorry for me if I didn't want to. And I had never known that before. I didn't know I chose to feel sorry for myself. I didn't know that. And so it struck me so funny, I burst out laughing on the freeway. And I came home, and I went into the house, and I'm still laughing. And John is in the kitchen doing something. And he hears me laughing, and he says, "What's so funny about you?" And just as he says that, I hear this great big crack from the kitchen. Now, we're in a new house. We have one of these Corningware countertop stoves, and I'm envisioning the countertop stove just cracking right down the middle. And I'm still laughing, and I'm walking in the kitchen. He says, "What's so funny about you?" And I said, "Well, on the way home, I had this overwhelming desire to feel sorry for myself." And he looks on top of the stove, where he has been boiling hot dogs in a Pyrex dish. And the Pyrex dish has cracked in half, and there's boiling, greasy hot dogs all over the stove, down into the cupboard, all over the kitchen floor. I'm telling him I want to feel sorry for myself. He looks at this mess, and in this little boy sheepy's voice, he says, "Is this reason enough?" And I said, "No, it isn't reason enough anymore." Because finally I realized that I was feeling the way I was feeling by choice. That finally sunk in. And so a few days later, I said to my husband as he came home from work, "I think I'll go to an Al-Anon meeting." And he got this funny look on his face. And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, I have problems too, you know." And that poor man turned as white as a sheet, and he almost fell off of the stairs. I had him so convinced for so many years that he was my only problem, that his drinking was my only problem, and he wasn't drinking. So why did I need to go to Al-Anon? And when I told him I have problems too, it was a total shock to that man. Boy, are we good. Are we good at convincing people it's their fault? He was convinced. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting knowing I needed help. And I walked through the threshold of the Tuesday night St. Luke's meeting on August 10th, 1976. And I needed help. And I took one step into that room and I looked around. And I saw 6 of the sickest women I have ever seen in my entire life. And I said to me, "Boy, these women need me." And obviously they did. Because you know what happened at the end of the meeting? At the end of the meeting, they all stood up and they held hands. And they said this prayer, And then they all asked me to keep coming back. And so I did. And so they let me. And I am so grateful to those six wonderful women that were in the room that night, because they knew where I was coming from. And they knew that this God of their understanding and my understanding uses our character defects to get us where He wants us to be. Now, my character defect, my major character defect, was and is pride and ego. And God knew that. And God knew that I needed to be needed. And God knew that I needed to feel as if I had something to offer these poor sick souls that were in that room. God knew that. I didn't know that. But those women allowed me to come back long enough for me to see how very much I needed them. They allowed me to talk when I couldn't put two sentences together that made sense. You know, when you're new in the program and all these awarenesses are just hitting you right and left? I would get called on in a meeting and I would share the beginning of this awareness and the middle of that one and the end of this one, and none of it made sense to anybody, but they let me talk anyway. And eventually, I got to the point where I could hear what I was saying. And eventually, I got to the point where I understood that I was there for me. Now, my sponsor made this perfectly clear. I got a sponsor shortly after I got to Al-Anon. And she was exactly what I needed, loving, caring, but oh boy, did she get to the point. Bob was talking about some of the words that he had to look up in the dictionary. I want to tell you, Bob, my sponsor in the first step, it says my life is unmanageable. My sponsor made me look up the word life. And she said, Peggy, when you come across a word that you know the meaning of, I want you to look that word up. And you know what the word life, what the definition of the word life on that day in Webster's dictionary, I don't know what it says today, but on that day, it said my life was my thinking. My thinking is unmanageable. I had to understand that I was powerless over alcohol. And I looked at my sponsor and I said, what do you mean I'm powerless over alcohol? I can pour it down the sink. I can let it evaporate. She said, Peggy, did you ever try to get someone to stop drinking alcohol? And I said, yes. She said, did it work? No. Did you ever try to get someone to behave differently when they were drinking alcohol? Yes. Did it work? No. And I began to understand just how much power I have over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. Let me tell you what I've been through and come through with such dignity and grace. Marriage to a physically abusive psychotic, the death of a 5-week-old child, marriage to an alcoholic, 8 kids, gone through attempted suicides, running away from home, the drug scene, the alcohol scene, shoplifting. I went through all of these things for my sponsor, just to show her, look what I've been through and how well I've come through. And she said, Peggy, did it ever enter your mind that if you had been managing your life a little better, a lot of this might not have happened? No, it had never entered my mind. Never entered my mind. In the second step, I had to look up the word sanity, because I knew that my husband was weird. But I was perfectly sane, thank you very much. My sponsor said, look it up, and you know what it said? Rational thinking. Oh, there's my thinking again. And God at that time revealed to me some of the thinking and some of the behavior that I had when my husband was drinking. My husband, when he was drinking, used to be susceptible to pneumonia. He would get bronchitis and it would turn into pneumonia, and he would have to spend some time in the hospital. Well, you know what I used to do in the dead of winter? He would come home and pass out on the couch. It was time for me to go to bed, so I would turn off the furnace, open up all the doors and windows, and I would go to bed. The next morning, I would get up real early, turn the furnace on, close up all the doors and windows, and wake my husband up. And he'd be all congested, and he'd have to go to the doctor, and the doctor would send him to the hospital. The last 4 years of my husband's drinking, he averaged 4 times a year in the hospital with pneumonia. But you know what? He didn't drink when he was in the hospital with pneumonia. He didn't die either, and for that I'm very grateful. You know, pneumonia is not something you play around with. And I did not know that I was trying to kill that man. You know, Al-Anons are the only people I know of in the entire world who love somebody so much that they will kill them to get them to quit drinking. And I tried. And I bet you some of you have your own little stories of how you tried. Because I love you so much, and I know that alcohol is killing you, and I'm going to kill you first. There's a big difference, in my opinion, between alcoholics and Al-Anons. Alcoholics, if they're having a problem like that with somebody, shoot, they pull a gun, they pull the trigger, and they think about the consequences later. Al-Anons will plot and plan. And when you stop to think about it, have you ever heard of anybody being convicted of murder by pneumonia? Well, obviously it works. My husband's sober. And I had nothing to do with it. I probably kept him out there longer than he needed to be. But he drank as much as he needed to drink, and I behaved as oddly as I needed to behave to get me to a program where people could love me. Love me enough to allow me to find out who I was, how I got to be that way, knowing I don't have to stay that way. And you know, nowhere in my program does it say that I get to predetermine who I'm going to become. What I get to do is to recognize how I got to be the way I am and accept that process and accept who I am. And then I get to turn all of that over to the care of a loving, living God. And I get to get to a point where I am willing to become whatever He wants me to be. And it is in steps 6 and 7 where I had that experience. And I think steps 6 and 7 get the short shift of things a lot. And yet to me, they were a big turning point in my program. Because what I knew I had discovered in 4 and 5, where I came from, how I got to be the way I was, and I got to look at this pride and ego that had ruled my life from day one. And I wanted to be rid of that. I truly wanted to be whatever it was God wanted me to be. And so what I did at step 6 is I went out into our garage all by myself. And I read through everything I could find on step 6. And what I knew was that I had to become absolutely ready and willing to be whatever God wanted me to be. And as I did that, this vision went through my head. And it was me standing on a corner with a bell ringing and saying, "Repent, ye sinners." Little bonnet on. And I didn't want to be that. That is not what I wanted to do. It was repulsive to me. That is not what I wanted to do. And so I recognized that was the most abhorrent thing that I could think of, that God might want me to be, and I knew that in my heart I had to be willing to do that. And so, through prayer, talking with God, and with the understanding that this is what I had to do, and this is where I had to be, I said, "Okay, God, If that is what you want me to do, I am willing and I am ready to go stand on that street corner with a bonnet and ring a bell, if that's what you want of me. And as soon as I got to that point, the God of my understanding gave me a piece of information that walks with me every day of my life. And that is that all I have to do is be ready and willing. That God will never ask of me anything that He has not first planted the seed of desire in my heart. If He wanted me to stand on a street corner and ring a bell, He would plant the desire to do that in my heart. So what is the struggle? You know, what is the fight? I think, oh no, a lot of the gals that I sponsor are single and were raised in Catholic homes. And the first thing that goes through their head is, oh no, He wants me to be a nun. And I share with them the information that I was given. If God wants you to be a nun, He will first plant in your heart a great desire to be a nun. So there will be no struggle. The struggle is getting ready. The struggle is being willing. The struggle is surrendering all of that, all of those exceptions. I will do whatever you want me to, God, except. Except I won't stay with my husband, I won't leave my husband, I won't be a nun, I won't ring a bell. You know, all of these things. I'll do whatever you want except. And it was in step 6 and 7 that I had to get to a point where I was totally and absolutely willing to do whatever He wanted me to do and become whatever He wanted me to become. And I know He's not through yet. And I have no idea what He has in mind. I ask Him all the time. You know, I am here. Here I am. Do with me whatever you will. And He has brought me through many, many experiences in our family's sobriety. Our youngest son was 8 years old when John got sober. And I was asked shortly after I got into the program to put on a workshop for the Serenity Prayer. And so I did what most newcomers who have to do a workshop do. I gathered everything I could gather, every bit of literature and books and the dictionary and everything on the Serenity Prayer. And I was going to have the greatest workshop known in the annals of Al-Anon. And it was going to be great, let me tell you. And I had pages of all this stuff that I was going to share at this workshop. Well, our 8-year-old was a television addict. And while I was doing all of this work, he was sitting in front of the television watching whatever he was watching. And he is the kid that, you know, when things would come up and you're new on Al-Anon and you look at the kid and you say, I guess it's time for the Serenity Prayer, God grant me. And they sit there. I don't want to hear that, Mom, not one more time. So he was watching television and I'm working diligently. And I said, Daniel, what do you think the Serenity Prayer means? And he looked at me and he said, well, I guess it means if they cancel my favorite TV show, there's nothing I can do about that. But if they cancel my favorite TV show and I get really angry, there's something I can do about that. And I took my papers and I and I tore them up and I threw them away. And we had the greatest workshop on an 8-year-old's interpretation of the Serenity Prayer, because that kid was right on. That kid is learning disabled. And he is so wise, it is sometimes frightening. When he was about, 13 or 14, we had planned a trip to the snow. And before we left, because my husband had to be back on a Monday, I called the highway patrol. And the highway patrol said, if you're going to go, plan to stay a lot longer than the weekend because you're going to be snowed in. So we had to change our plans. And this 14-year-old son was extremely angry. He wanted to go to the snow. He had been looking forward to it, and we couldn't go. And he looked at me, and he said, "Mom, I am really angry. Can I go in the bathroom and say whatever I want to say?" I said, "Sure, go ahead." He went in the bathroom. He turned on all the water and flushed the toilet. And out of the bathroom, I heard this big, "Shit!" Now, this is very out of character with me around anyway. But I was laughing because it was just so neat that he could do that. And he came out of the bathroom, and we had all our stuff in the car, and he looked at me and he said, "I'm not going." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I think we'll all go down to the Madonna Inn in, I think it's Paso Robles or wherever. It's a really neat place." It was pouring rain. He said, "Nope, I don't think I'm going to go. I don't want to go. I wanted to go to the snow, and I don't want to go." And I said, "Well, I think the three of us will go anyway." And he looked at me, hands on hips, and he said, "Mom, you have always told me that I have a choice. Are you telling me now I don't have a choice? And let me tell you what Al-Anon had done for me up to that time." I looked at this kid, and I said, "Daniel, you always have a choice. You may not always like what your choices are, but you always have a choice." And he said, "Well, what are my choices if I have to go?" And I said, "Well, you can either go and have a really good time, or you can go and have a miserable time. And that's your choice." He looked at me and he said, "Well, some choice." And stomped out. Got in the back seat of the car and promptly fell asleep. We got down to Paso Robles and we got our room, and they're the ones that have these rock falls and all this weird stuff in the rooms. And we were walking across the parking lot to our room. And this 14-year-old walks up to me and puts his arm through mine. And he says, "Mom, I'm really having a good time. I'm glad we came here." Do you know what I would have done before program? It would have been a battle of wills. You are going because I say so. You will have a good time. And you will have it the way I want you to have it. I'm the mom, you're the kid, get in the car, shut up, we're going. I had to win before the program. I had to be right. And a lot of that, I understand today, was out of fear. I had this misconception that if my 8 kids found out that I was wrong, that they would lose respect for me. I truly believed that, and there was a lot of fear behind pretending to be something that I wasn't, pretending to be right when I wasn't. And what made me think that these bright kids didn't know? But I really thought if they thought I could make a mistake, they would lose respect for me. And of course, they didn't have any respect for me because I was crazy. The respect didn't come until after Al-Anon, until I was able to go to them and make amends to them and share with them what had been going on all those years inside of me. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't know what I was feeling. I had so shoved them down, denied them, stuffed them, called them something else, rationalized them, justified them, done all the things we do, that by the time I got here, my stomach felt like a blender. And there were just all of these emotions and feelings that had been blended up in this blender, and I could not pull one out and say, "Oh, this is anger. Oh, this is fear." You know, I was almost 3 years in the program before I recognized that I even had resentment. It got to the point where I would go to a meeting and the topic would be resentment. And I would sit there and think, "Well, now do I be honest and tell them I don't have any? Or do I make some up if they call on me?" And I had reached what I thought was a real growth place for me. I had reached a place where when the topic was resentment, and if I got called on, I could share with them that I didn't have any resentment. I have never been an angry person. And then one day, I was reading this little golden book by Father John Doe, and there's a chapter on resentments. And at first I thought, well, I don't need to read this chapter because I don't have any resentments, right? And I thought, well, I might as well read it. He went to the trouble to write it, right? So I gave him the honor of my reading his chapter. And the very first sentence under resentment, the very first two words, self-pity, and I'm saying, what's self-pity doing here under resentment? And it had a little asterisk by the word self-pity. And down at the bottom of the page, it said, self-pity, the coward's form of resentment. And after I got over being angry at his definition of my drug of choice, the light came on. And I realized that I had gotten so good at observing or judging a situation or a person or a place or a thing, judging it and jumping directly into self-pity. Do not pass resentment. Do not collect $200. Just go directly to self-pity. And what I have discovered has been real interesting for me, because I recognize that what we do with our resentments, we do two things. We take them and we dive into, we don't like what's going on, okay? So we get a resentment. Then we go into self-pity. Poor me, look what I have to put up with. Look what this person is doing. Look how wonderful I am. Poor me. And self-pity then goes into depression. Depression goes into self-destruction. And self-destruction goes into suicide. And that's the process. And so I recognize self-pity. And I had to bring it back. How can I feel sorry for myself about something if I don't think it's not going the way I want it to in the first place? And so I recognized what I did with it. The other end of the spectrum is, and this is where I was confused, something that is going on and we don't like it. So we get angry. Anger turns into rage. Rage turns outward into abuse. And abuse turns into murder. And these are the things that we do. And it all starts with the resentment. And if I can recognize whatever stage I'm in, and most of us will go from one side to the other side, to one side, you know, first we feel sorry for ourselves and then we want to kill somebody. You know, we just go, you know, bounce anywhere we want. But I had to recognize the pattern and to understand that all of this bizarre behavior stem from a resentment that I thought I didn't have. I thought when you were resentful that you got angry. Well, I don't know how to do anger. I don't know how to do that. So it was much easier for me just to jump into self-pity. Poor me. Poor me. I will marry an alcoholic, I will raise 8 children, and I will always have a reason to be in self-pity. I didn't know until I read that little footnote in a book. And everything opened up. And I began to understand me a little bit better. And as I go through the program of Al-Anon and continue to grow and do and share and carry the message and live the message and learn the message, as I grow in this program, more and more of me gets revealed. I work with a lot of women, and they teach me so much. There is no way that I can experience every experience on the face of this earth. It's humanly impossible. And so I get to experience the experiences of the ladies that I sponsor. They come to me and we both learn. They will never know how much they have taught me. And I do understand, and I had to get this understanding. When I first started sponsoring women, I was so excited about how much I was learning that it never dawned on me, gee, I wonder if they're learning anything. And I understand that when someone comes to me and they take a fifth step with me, that it really isn't important what I learn. It really is important what they learn. But, heck, they're going to learn something. They have to. And I get to learn a whole lot. And I don't know what I would do without the gals that I sponsor. I've had three sponsors in this program, and all three of them have moved away. And do you know that I was into my third sponsor, and she was getting ready to leave, and this had been over a period of, 10 years maybe. She was getting ready to move away, and it finally dawned on me, do you know all of my sponsors are only a phone call away? I thought I had to rush out and get another one. But it's the ladies that I sponsor that have been such a support through the last several years for me. I love this man that I used to try to kill. And 7.5 years ago, he had his first heart attack. And as a result of that, he learned a lot, and so did I. I learned that I was awful glad that he had lived as long as he had lived, and I was not ready to let go of him. And I learned something about a prayer that I'd been saying for as long as I could remember. And that prayer was, "Thy will be done, not mine." And it dawned on me through this experience of John's first heart attack and triple bypass that I could not even utter that prayer. I was absolutely consumed with terror, and I was so full of fear and terror that I couldn't pray, I couldn't talk to God, I couldn't even say, "Thy will be done, not mine." And it wasn't until he was recovering from his surgery that I had to go into some prayer and meditation and do some step work and find out why. Why, for the first time in my life, I could not pray. And what I realized was that somewhere in the back of my little head, that prayer, "Thy will be done, not mine," meant that God's will could not possibly be the same as mine. That God's will must always be the opposite of mine. And I know that's not true. I absolutely know that is not true. But since that time, I have had to change. I've had to change that prayer. Because I know what all those years of saying that had somehow gotten into my head. That if I say, "Your will be done, not mine," that means yours is different than mine. And that's not always true. And so today I say, "May my will be your will, and may your will be my will." That's the goal. And it's got nothing to do with, you know, if everything I wanted was contrary to God's will, wouldn't it be easy to figure out what God's will was? It would always be the opposite of mine. How easy. Well, he doesn't make it that easy. You know, sometimes his will for me is what I want. And sometimes what I want is really his will for me. But not always. Because if it was always, that would be too easy. I think he doesn't like to make things easy for us all the time. So I learned a lot, John learned a lot. And in May of this year, John had his second heart attack. And once again, my whole reaction to that was so different than it had been 7.5 years ago. And I didn't know that I had changed. Now, I know that if I'm in this program, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I check in with God every morning. I say, "Here I am. What can I do for you this morning?" And then go ahead and do my day. I'm going to grow. I'm going to change. I'm going to get better. Every day, I'm going to get better. But I can't always see the growth in me. I see it in you, but I don't always see it in me. I don't really look for it. But what I recognize in is when something similar happens 7.5 years later, and my response is so entirely different. Do you know that I did not feel that fear, that terror? John came home to have his heart attack with me, which which may sound like a funny kind of thing to do, but, you know, I really appreciated it, if that makes any sense at all. The first one, I got a phone call. Your husband's in the hospital. He's had a heart attack. We don't know if he's going to live or not. And I just went crazy. This one, he started having at the gym where he was working out, doing what he was supposed to do. And he came home so that he could say goodbye. And so I got to go through his heart attack with him. I got to call 911. I got to do for him what he needed to be done at the time. I was listening. They were telling me what to do, and I was participating. And my reaction was so entirely different. I never lost contact with God. God was with both of us through that whole thing. I was talking to God. I was praying to God. I was listening to God, which was totally different than it had been 7.5 years ago. I often get asked, especially, I don't know why this is coming up, but somebody must need to hear it, maybe me. I get asked an awful lot by parents of children. How do I know? How do I know what to do? Where that line is between enabling and ignoring? You know, where is that line? And the information I have on that is because I needed it. But this learning disabled child, I think it will always be difficult to determine what are his needs and what is he capable of doing, all of those things, and where am I overstepping my boundaries, which I do all the time. But I went to the God of my understanding and I asked him, you know, where is this line? You know, how do I determine what is enabling? And, you know, what's doing too much and what's doing not enough? And God said to me, how do I treat my children? And I said, whoa, I know how you treat your children. You do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. But you never do for us what we're capable of doing for ourselves. And that's a guideline that I use. Now, the difference is that God always knows what I'm capable of doing and what I'm not capable of doing. And I don't always know what other people are capable of or not capable of. But it's a real good guideline. And I use that. In raising children, I have had so many awarenesses. This kid that was 8 years old and is learning disabled, and I have learned so much from raising that kid. He was going through that stage where you put him to bed and they'll come up to you and they'll say, I love you. And you know they're asking a question. They're not making a statement. They're asking a question. I love you. And I say, I love you too. And it doesn't answer the question. They're still seeking. They're still searching. Well, he was going through this stage. And so I went to the God of my understanding and I said, God, something's going on here and I need help. Daniel is looking for something and I don't seem to be able to give it to him. And God said to me, what is it you want him to know? And I said, well, I want him to know that he's loved, and I tell him that. And God says, what is it that you say? I said, I love you too. And God says, what is it you want him to know? Well, I want him to know that he's loved. Well, why don't you tell him just that? Well, I do. I say, I love you too. And God says, what is it you want him to know? I want him to know he's loved. Well, why don't you tell him just that? And about a dozen times through this little thing, it dawns on me, I could have had a V8. Oh. So the next night when I put Daniel to bed, he looks at me and he says, I love you. And I looked at him and I said, oh, Daniel, you are loved. And his whole face just lit up. And to this day, and this kid is 5'10", 220 weight lifter, to this day he will walk in our house and look for me. And he'll say to me, you are too. And I know what he's saying. I'm loved too. And you know, that's a statement that you can say to a kid, whether you're loving them at the time or not, you are loved. Because you know what? God has always loved them. Even when I can't, even when I don't like what they're doing. And I just can't muster up that, but God loves him, so I'm not lying ever. I would put Daniel to bed, and at the end of the prayers, I would say, "You're such a good boy." And one night, I put him to bed and said, "You're such a good boy," and he got this look on his face that said, "I am not, I'm bad." And I went into the God of my understanding, and I said, "God, something is going on here, and I need help." And within a few days, I understood that when an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 58-year-old has done something they know they shouldn't have done, and you say, "You're a good boy," their mind says, "No, I'm not, I'm bad." And so what I recognized was I needed to take that phrase out of what I was saying to this child. And the next night, I put him to bed. I told him he was loved, and I looked at him and I said, "Daniel, you're one of the nicest people I know." And I could see his mind going, "What's the opposite of nice? Oh, well, shoot, I can't find it. I guess I'm nice." And he just lit up. And he was about 9 years old when this went on. He went to a special school and graduated from high school from this special education school. When he was 14 years old, it was his first week at this school. And the teacher had the kids all go up to the blackboard and write a description of themselves. And then the parents were coming that night, and the parent was supposed to walk around and see if they could recognize the description of their own child. I walked in that room. I looked on the blackboard, and I walked right over, and I said, "That's Daniel." You know what it said? "I'm short, I'm fat, and I'm a very nice person." This program has given me back my family. We have 8 children. We have 21 grandchildren. We have 5 great-grandchildren. And one of the reasons that I do not say no to carrying the message of Al-Anon is because I want this program to be here for my great-grandchildren. 4 of our great-grandchildren are living in an active, abusive, alcoholic home. Their parents don't know that they need help. But I want this program to be here, and I want Alateen to be here, and I want the preteens to be here, so that one day, when my great-grandkids reach out and say, "I need help," I want somebody to be here. And I will go to any length to see that this message gets carried wherever it needs to get carried. I have talked at schools. I have talked to doctors. I have talked to you name it. And I will carry this message until I can't carry it anymore. The message is not going to go away. I might. But behind me, somebody else will come along. And maybe they will have heard something. And maybe they will say, "It is now my time to carry the message wherever it needs to be carried." This is a family disease. It goes on and on and on. We know that my husband's father was an alcoholic and died of the disease of alcoholism. We know that John is an alcoholic. Of our 8 children, most of them are married to alcoholics. As far as we know, none of our children, why I don't know, are active alcoholics, as far as we know. But most of their spouses are either sober or still drinking or trying or whatever. And therefore, their children have, odds are, you know, they're being raised in an alcoholic home, they're going to need help. And their children and their children and their children. And the beauty of this overview that I get is that we live in a disease that has a generational pattern. And we get to contribute recovery to that generational pattern. Not that everybody in the whole family tree is going to get it, because odds are they're not. But we are going to give those who want it a branch of recovery. And I want us to be here for my great-grandkids and yours. So thank you for having me tonight, and thank you for being here. And you are all loved, and so am I. Thank you.
Right on.